back 3 years ago, Mr. Beast blew up $600,000 of fireworks in one of his videos. Right. And like, and so from that perspective, like, he had to have $600,000 to invest into that video.
Welcome back to the Influence Factor by the Influencer Marketing Factory. Today with me, we have Brian Harwit, that is the partner at CoVenture. If you are enjoying these episodes and this show, don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, to follow us on YouTube and Spotify so that you can get easily notified about new episodes every single Wednesday. Enjoy the show. Hey, Brian, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. You know, today it's an interesting topic, right? We're talking about, you know, funding and capital for content creators and people that work in the creator economy. There is, you know, so much going on, but at the same time, still a lot of confusion, I would say, right? And still a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of translation when it comes to capital and content creators. So very interesting episode. And first of all, who is Brian? And tell us a bit more about yourself and also what is CoVenture?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a partner at CoVenture. We're an alternative credit asset manager, primarily focused on tech companies. And so working with technology-enabled businesses, either financing assets that they originate, which we can get into a bit more. In one case, it's YouTube content catalogs and music royalty streams, things along those lines, as also later stage companies and growth funding and providing credit and credit-like solutions to those businesses. Before working at CoVenture, I did some time in investment banking. And prior to that, had, you know, in college focused on helping different venture capital funds. And then on the side, have an interest in a lot of friends sort of in the creative space, have acted in TikToks, have helped people review contracts for brand deals, all sorts of things along those lines. So the creator space has always been quite interesting to me.
Fantastic. Is there anything specific that you liked from the content creator side that you were like, you know what, I want to move from the typical more traditional investment banking to this new type of thing?
Yeah, I think it was really interesting. And it's sort of like one of the primary theses of CoVenture is, how is technology providing access to capital and financial services where people weren't able to previously access financial services? And a lot of that is built off of technology or new platforms that are allowing people to generate revenues. So YouTube it was sort of like the first foray into this, where we said, okay, there's YouTubers that are making multiple millions of dollars a year, but don't have access to traditional financial services. And a lot of that was because the banks don't really know how to underwrite YouTube catalogs. They look at it and they say, all right, you have huge spikes in Q4 and then it's inconsistent across the year and we have no idea how to make sense of this. Whereas if you apply data in sort of machine learning models and large data sets, there's ways of underwriting. And you had obviously Aaron from Spotter on your podcast before. And that was sort of our introduction to learning, hey, there's this really interesting ecosystem where revenue is being generated in a predictable manner that can finally be financed. And so we started digging around and looking into more types of businesses and creators in that space. And given I have, you know, friends who are creators, I became personally very interested in the problem of like, how can I continue to find ways of either creating financing or predictable monetization for these people in this ecosystem? Because it was clearly an industry that outside of YouTube has a lot of like lumpy revenue streams.
Absolutely. Makes sense, right? So one of the questions that exactly for you was you know, exactly this, right? A lot of content creators, influencers out there, they make some of them a really good amount of money every single year, more than a living, I would say. Yeah. Some of them is more, you know, like I would say a bit unstable, right? Certain months they maybe close a brand deal for like 5K, then the next month nothing, then maybe 27K, you know, it's always like that. With YouTube, of course, right, we said with the CPM models, it's a bit more easy to forecasting. But do you think that they, so again, you know, they're making money, there is billions in the creator economy. So my question for you, and you already said that already, you know, but I wanted to expand a bit more on that. Why there is no, you know, financial, I would say, and capital access to content creators? Is it mostly because it's a bit unstable to predict their type of like, you know, income, or is it, is there anything else? Maybe because it's still too new for some people in the traditional business. What is that?
Yeah, so it's platform dependent. And so I think, you know, in the label and music world, there's these like 360 deals where you're essentially advancing and taking cuts of all of the revenue sources for musicians. There's no real equivalent of that. And I think a lot of that is the revenue streams are still too nascent. So YouTube is the most mature. The monetization platform has been going on for a decade. And so I think it's easier to look at the data set and say, okay, this is what the historical viewership decay has looked like, how video goes from month one to month 10. And here's what the historical cost per thousand impressions is for this type of creator. And then from there you can back into like what the predicted revenues are going to be. And so like there's a longer set of data points there from a platform perspective. Whereas you look at other platforms like TikTok, like Instagram, Facebook, even Twitch, there's a lot less predictability in the monetization. And in certain instances like Twitch, it's requiring that you're live streaming and there's continuing an ongoing process, and that's harder to underwrite. Like, is a creator going to burn out? How likely are they going to continue to produce content at the same rate? So there's a whole bunch of different variables. And the existing infrastructure from a financial perspective just wasn't there. If you think about a relationship manager at a bank, they're not incentivized to take risk on a YouTube creator, and they don't know how to understand the cash flows that are coming from it. And the same thing goes for people generating cap revenues in non-traditional ways. And so that's where this wave of companies that are looking at financing both short-term and long-term, how creators access capital. So Spotr, you mentioned briefly, is a perfect example of this. This is a company that came in and has purchased or provided creators over $750 million. Like, that's a pretty substantial amount of capital to provide to the ecosystem. And they just got named, Time's top 100 influential company. Like, they've really stood out, and like they've been able to work with the top tier creators, the Mr. Beast, the DoPerfects of the world, and show that this is a path for the largest creators, which will make it a path that hopefully smaller creators will pursue as well. So that's sort of on the longer term, larger size financing. And then there's other options, sort of longer tail. There's Carrot, which offers obviously like a spend card, and other companies that are in that space. So there's a lot of interesting ways. I think now companies that are utilizing technology that are creator native, that have that blend of fintech and creator, are coming to offer these types of products.
So you said, big amounts, right? So from Spotr, 750 million in content creators. There are other options also for for helping them and so on. And what is the type of investment, right, that content creators do with that money? Is it like investing in better devices and cameras? Is this like in hiring a team? Is it investing, let's say, in merchandising, a bit of everything? Are you finding any partners or any, anything that is like most popular right now?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So I think I break this into two buckets. One is business. These creators are becoming media businesses. So some of them, they're generating millions, some are tens of millions of dollars a year. And so they're hiring writers, film crews, camera people, editors, you name it. So there's that component of it. They're building out offices, film facilities, production facilities. I think Mr. Beast is a perfect segue here again to mention his name again, where he has 60 full-time employees. He's building out production facilities in North Carolina that are going to, be able to house all these operations. And then the second component outside of building out the teams and media companies is the videos oftentimes are expensive to produce. And so I think people will rest, oh, it's a YouTube video, you film it on a camera and like it's easy. But like one example, since recording this on the 5th of July, if we go back 3 years ago, Mr. Beast blew up $600,000 of fireworks in one of his videos, right? And like, and so from that perspective, like he had to have $600,000 to invest into that video and had to wait to get paid back as the viewership came in on that video. And so I think, as I see it, it's sort of twofold. It's like investing in the business itself and then investing in the content. And looking at it from a working capital perspective, that you're tying up significant quantities of capital, putting money into videos that you're going to produce.
And what about smaller creators? Because Mr. Beast will know him as 600K for like fireworks is not for everyone. So what about maybe smaller that are either want to step up the game and get into the next level, or maybe those that have already maybe a couple of people that want just to maybe produce more and so on. So it's still about the quality of the content, or are you also noticing anything that is maybe indirect somehow to the creation of the content? Like are they using that maybe to expand on their business and let's say multiply themselves with other income streams? Is that also something that they are doing right now or not really?
Yeah, I would say it's primarily focused on content, because that's, I think at that stage, when you have that level of sort of like the smaller end of creator, it feels like, how can I continue to level up the content? And so in certain instances, I have friends who are like, well, if I just had a little bit more money, I could hire an editor who could increase the output of my content, because I spend so much time editing that it takes away from the time that I can spend thinking of content and filming content. So it's like, editing seems like the lowest hanging fruit from the perspective of like what frees up a creator to have more time to create. Besides that, it could be equipment, similar to editing. If you have an old computer that doesn't have the processing power to actually compress and edit the content, that can take a pretty meaningful amount of time. And so like having the right content for, you know, if you're filming a lot of videos, having like a gimbal, which is a thing that stabilizes video as you're shooting in movement, having you know, new camera, all these other equipment, it's expensive, right? These are all $1,000+ purchases. And so having access to that is sort of table stakes. And so sort of the equipment itself and then having access to editing resources, I'd say, are the two main ones for the smaller creators.
Is your brand ready to amplify its reach? Well, the Influencer Marketing Factory is here for you. We are a global influencer marketing agency helping brands ignite their growth. From influencer identification to campaign strategy, handling legalities and agreements, to managing shipping and logistics, we got you all covered. We work with hundreds of brands across different verticals, from Fortune 500 companies to direct-to-consumer brands. And we don't just stop there. With detailed ROI analysis, we help brands like yours measure success, transforming impressions into conversions. You can find us at theinfluencermarketingfactory.com or just searching The Influencer Marketing Factory on Google.
Very interesting. And on that note, right? So we, you know, mentioned before Mr. Beast, now a bit more about like smaller creators, but is there anything specific that come to your mind? Any maybe successful case studies of content creators that started doing like, you know, maybe videos even more professionally speaking, you know, thanks to these top of like, you know, financial and capital support. Is there anyone that comes to your mind that you maybe can mention?
It's a very good question. I think that there are definitely some public, you know, proponents. I think Spotter has many of them who've come out and said, yeah, these are huge. And I think like Mr. Beast is probably one of the bigger proponents because he's got so many endeavors. I think one of the things you're probably alluding to before was, you know, he has Feastables and Mr. Beast Burger, and he's got all these other side projects. And so having additional capital is really important. And that way you don't have to take on, in this instance, you're not taking on debt, you're not taking on dilution from equity perspective, you're just using sort of the back catalog to help finance your business. And so I would say the growth in Mr. Beast just himself from the first time that we did a deal, that Spotter did a deal with them up until now has just been tremendous. So I think that's a great case study. Obviously, you know, he's a special talent and did a lot of this, you know, through hard work and determination, but having the access to capital is definitely critical for his growth.
Let's jump for a second from the content creator side, right, that we, you know, already kind of covered, right, like their needs,
yeah,
why something's difficult, and the stability of their income and so on. Let's jump from them to social media, right? We all know that social media in the past years have been trying to basically fight each other, so like, you know, just to get, you know, more content creators on. We saw in the past TikTok with the founder that unfortunately didn't work that, you know, that well. Instagram with the different bonuses also a bit bumpy sometimes. YouTube also, they tried a different model with the YouTube Shorts, but very low CPMs. Yeah. So first of all, what do you think, like how they are doing right now? And if they are not that good right now, in terms of many, mostly financially speaking, right, in terms of support, what is missing? And what social media could and should do better for content creators?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And I think the news this past couple of weeks between Twitch and Kick has been really interesting, right? It's like creating competitive dynamics across platforms, especially for people that are live streaming, because that's one where you can't really be live streaming on multiple platforms, and that creates a natural dynamic that's much more competitive. And so Twitch has had pressure to switch their revenue monetization split out. As a result of Kick coming and stealing a bunch of their customers. Facebook has, you know, their Meta has their own product here, YouTube has their own product. And so I think there's a lot of different competition, and competition will breed better results for creators from a patent split perspective. So I think like live streaming is its own bucket, but I'm excited to see that there's been some competitive dynamics at play there. YouTube, I think, is just the most predictable. I think from that perspective, long form at least, where people are, you know, feel pretty happy about it. The 55-45 split is consistent and people are earning a good living off of it. I think the shorts was a bit of a distraction. It seems like you were mentioning that the CPMs are so low, even people getting nine figures of viewership are not making that much money off of it. And so I think it's been a little bit of a distraction that some creators are like, should I spend even any time focusing on this, or should I just be focusing on long form? And so I think that's something that the platforms need to do a better job of. And then, like you mentioned, TikTok and Instagram, just the monetization has been so in, you know, so random in some senses. They keep changing the model. And for TikTok, the viewership is completely random as well. So like my friends who are TikTok creators, so like it's like pulling a slot machine. Sometimes you'll have a video that you've been working really hard on for 30 hours and it gets, you know, a third of the views of a video that you put no effort into, and that just pops because that's, you know, the way the algorithm works. And so I think the predictability from a viewership perspective also plays in there. And TikTok has a lot of content that's reposting of videos of like clips from old TV shows that takes away from creators who are properly monetizing and creating their own content. So there's I think TikTok can do a better job of figuring out ways of carving those out of the monetization equation. So I think those, and also TikTok and Instagram have not done a great job from the perspective of pairing up people with brands. That's where you come in, obviously. And I think there's been those marketplaces have been largely ineffective, and some of them have been sunset from those two platforms. And so that's, you know, it's been a bit of a challenge. But I think, like, how can you create predictability? How can you create transparency? How can you create better backend reporting the way YouTube does to make it clear how much the creator is earning and how much effort they should be putting onto the platform? So I think those are some of the things that I've observed.
Thank you for that. I like when you say, you know, predictability, right? Because, you know, again, it's very difficult sometimes, but, you know, with YouTube, we mentioned already, you know, several times on this episode that is the more stable, right? Has been there for more than 15 years. It's a CPM model, depending on the industry, location, and many other factors, right? So when you give debt, right, to purchase YouTube libraries, so first of all, if you can expand a bit more, like what does it mean, right? Because many people maybe listening don't know about debt, don't know about what does it mean to purchase YouTube, you know, libraries. So first of all, if you can just explain a bit more, what is the concept? And also, how do you, without getting too in-depth and technical, but how do you calculate, right? Is there a formula? Is there an algorithm that look at specific things? That would be nice just to see, you know, inside this black box, how does it work from the inside?
Yeah, and a lot of this is learned from the folks at Spotter and you know, things that they've discussed publicly. But yeah, they're licensing agreements or purchase agreements of certain videos uploaded by a creator. And those content is already historically uploaded. You have the data in YouTube, and that can be understood and analyzed pretty quickly. And you feed that data, which is primarily viewership and CPM, cost per thousand impressions or revenue per thousand impressions from the creator's perspective. And you look at that, you multiply those two feed functions together, and you get what the revenue is on a go-forward basis. And so in most cases, it's understanding the seasonality of the revenue per thousand impressions, which is pretty straightforward because Q4 has the highest, just given that's when advertisers are spending the most capital. And then viewership is understanding by category, by creator, what the decay curve looks like for each of those content creators. And so in some instances, like news clips are going to decay 99% in that first month because no one's really watching old news clips, whereas other creators that have longer form content that you know, new fans of those creators are coming in and watching old and old content that's evergreen. I keep coming back to Mr. Beast, but he's got a lot of evergreen content. Those creators might have a very different decay profile. And so it's about utilizing technology to understand that and create predictive viewership numbers and predictive revenue per thousand impression numbers to understand what a forward-looking revenue projection looks like.
Perfect. And do you have like any interesting / exciting / funny, whatever it's going to be, like, you know, either metrics or insights about these? Like, have you noticed, for example, that you can, like, can you say, for example, if someone comes to you and be like, you know, I have this amount of, like, you know, average views in this industry, have you noticed either a pattern or something? Like, can you easily potentially, like, you know, answer to that question or not really? And also, like, is there any other metrics or things that you didn't imagine, like you didn't even guess, and they were like, oh, wow, this is actually interesting after reading some of the data?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's really varied. So I think the three main pieces are going to be the geography, the type of content, and the specific content creator. So if your viewership is coming from international, that puts a pretty big dampener on CPM that you're earning, because, you know, the monetization is much higher for US-based views. Similarly, kids viewership monetizes a significantly lower rate. There's a lower call to action. A lot of the viewers are unmonetized through YouTube's kids platform. And then the third one is the creator. So there are certain creators that are part of, you know, YouTube Select or other programs that allow them to monetize their CPMs at a higher rate. So there's not a really clean answer. We did some outside research, and I think, like, for creators that have over 1 million views on their channel, somewhere in the ballpark of $3 from a CPM perspective is where we've seen things shake out. But again, I think it's very challenging because of all the different variables that are in play.
And so, and how does it work there? Like, do you run the numbers, you crunch them, and then it's like, okay, you know, this is what we can forecast. We're going to buy the library for what, like X amount of time, and then it's back to you. And like, how does it work, the type of agreement usually?
Yeah, typically there's a set period of time in which the cash flows would go to the spotter in this instance. And I want to be careful for not speaking too much for them, but yeah. You know, and then the cash flows revert back to the creator after that period of time. And so it's set up in a way that there's not that emotion of like, I'm giving these videos up forever. There is the, I'm giving it up for a certain period of time. And then the cash flows during that period of time are going to spotter to compensate for that upfront payment to finance the creator.
Let's also like, you know, go a bit more in detail when it comes to the opportunities, right? For content creators, like to make money, because we mostly mention about like, you know, YouTube and the CPM model, because it's the one we said a bit more stable and, you know, predictable. But what are some of the other ways that you are either helping directly or that you maybe are working with other companies, right, that you are either financing or giving capital to? So what are the best ways nowadays and opportunities for content creators to make money nowadays?
Yes, so there's, I think it's all platform based, and I think you were talking before about brand building brands and building products. And so we have an affiliate venture capital business called Crossbeam, and Crossbeam recently made an investment in a company called Warren James. Warren James is a high-end creator merch business, and so their focus is, let's not build whatever regular products for creators. Let's try to build high-end brands for creators. And so when you're a creator going and figuring out how to build a merch line, you have three real options. One is to do it yourself, take it in-house, take all the upside, but also take all the downside, hold inventory, do risk on that, manage shipping, you know, all the rigmarole that goes into it. The second option is to do sort of a generic, put your logo on a t-shirt or a sweatshirt and drop ship it and sell as each units go by. Or you work with someone like Warren James. It's a high-end creator that can help you build a brand and a real merchandise line. And then going beyond that, they now have other products, launching comic books, launching food and beverage products, and really helping sort of spearhead the creator and offering the creator a revenue split in that or a profit split in that allows them to participate in a lower risk way than having to take it in-house and taking on a lot of the operational responsibilities there. So I think that's been good. I mean, I think from my perspective that, you know, merch and food and beverage products makes a lot of sense, because as someone who follows a bunch of different creators, there is that inner passion to help support and make sure that they continue to do well. And I remember during the pandemic, I watched a lot of videos from Binging with Babish, who's one of my favorite creators. And I was like, I'm buying the cookbook. I'm buying his little tiny whisk that he sells. And like, it's a silly little thing, but I really wanted to support him because I was enjoying watching his videos on a weekly basis. And so I think like that's a perfect example is as creators continue to build and strengthen their audiences, there's more revenue monetization opportunities through that. And I think the merch has offered some level of predictable monetization as well. So that's merchandise, food and beverage, however you want to call it. I think that's one landscape there. There's other platforms that we're looking at. They're probably a little too early from a debt capital or some of these licensing agreement conversations because the data is not long enough to do that. So there's another investment out of Crossbeam called Infinite Canvas. They're helping essentially professionalize for user-generated content creators on Roblox, Minecraft, and Fortnite Creative. So it's a smaller ecosystem. I think Roblox paid out like $600 million in 2022 to creators. It's nothing to scoff at, right? It's like, it's still a pretty big number. And how do you like create professionalization around those creators and allow them to grow and build their businesses? And so I think that's small, but growing really quickly. And same thing on sort of the digital streaming side of things. We were invested in a company called STEM that was helping build out essentially a financial operating system for independent musicians who are not distributing through major labels. And so they're building key products to help independent musicians operate. So those are other platforms that are enabling monetization and access to financing. And then, sorry, one last product that I mentioned is platforms like Kajabi, where you're offering courses and coursework to fans of creators, whether that's fitness creators or DIY creators, and that's been a huge monetization unlock. I mean, they've generated over $5 billion since inception for people on the platform. And so it's been a really meaningful opportunity for a lot of creators.
Fascinating. And on Kajabi, we also actually had, you know, like Kajabi on one of the, you know, previous episodes, we, you know, talked about, you know, different tools, right? To so for anyone listening that is also interested, there is also a very, very cool episode. Fascinating also about Roblox. Like, you know, many people still think that it's just this place for kids where they, yeah, you know, spend time, but actually some of them are like, you know, very young and killing it. They are like creating all these different, like, you know, places, and they sell all these items, right? They're only digital, and some brands they got in and they sold their, like, you know, I think it was Gucci and some others, right? Their items, like digital items of bags that were more expensive there than on store, right? It's crazy.
It's amazing. I mean, it's created this whole group of entrepreneurial sort of like creator user generated content. And I think that's, if you think about how did YouTube start, it was kind of the same thing, right? People were just uploading videos on there, seeing if people would watch them. And it went from user generated content platform to sort of this professional video platform over the course of the last two decades. And I think that's been an interesting transition. And we expect that to happen as a lot of these social platforms or gaming platforms professionalize. And the first step there is institutionalizing, providing capital, providing infrastructure. And so I think that's where Roblox is an exciting next potential avenues. Like there's all these people who are making full-time living. Some kids who are making more than their parents just by creating games on Roblox. It's really amazing the opportunities that are afforded via these platforms. And I think, you know, we're moving more and more towards the professionalization of these user-generated content.
100%, also because you are removing all the physical assets that you have to build. So you don't have to get an office. You do not need to print anything. It's basically all online with an already existing platform that helps you, right? Like you don't even have to create the platform. You have all the tools to create your different servers and, you know, items and everything that you can sell, right? And then you can have, you know, reselling places, right, for those items. And then you can have advertisement into Roblox, right? That is already happening, right, with people putting QR code there that you can explore during that. So it's quite fascinating. And also on something that you said at the beginning, so, you know, about like, you know, cooking channels and everything. I also love that channel that you mentioned. Big fan. I saw that he also created his own line of, you know, knives and everything. So on that, many creators ask this question: when should I start, you know, diversify, right, my portfolio of offering? And I know there is no a clear answer because it depends. But have you noticed, is there any sort of either tipping point for a creator when they're like, you know what, okay, I have enough of a strong audience base, then now I can, let's say, do this first drop? So first of all, have you noticed that something there? Again, very difficult, I know, to answer. Yeah. And then secondly, yeah, on that, is there like something that you should do as first thing? Like, is it always the merchandising just to test the water and then you do something bigger, or do you should do mostly what you care about? So for example, cooking, then let's do one, like, you know, knives and so on. Like, do we have any idea on that?
Yeah, I think it's going to depend entirely on the creator and how engaged their audience is. So one of the things that you want to be careful of is if you're ordering a bunch of things that you're going to sell, that you don't over order. Because like, I think the way of doing it first is testing a product that you don't have to hold inventory on. Because I think what can go poorly is, all right, oh, I think I'm going to sell 10,000 of these shirts. You order 10,000 shirts and then only 3,000 sell. Now you got 7,000 shirts that you're going to have to, you know, fire sale and lose money on. And so it's like, what are the test cases of ways of understanding the demand of my audience? And so if you're really just testing out merch, maybe you say like, how do I do something that's more like a drop shipping model where I'm just putting on a, you know, a label or something onto a piece of clothing and then selling it through that. The other piece is like when you start working with a third party provider that can handle all that for you. So all you're doing is essentially promoting it using your fans and channels. And I think like finding a third party, that typically happens as you get to larger scale. So I think it really depends. But I would say trying to do something where it's not taking a lot of risk, where you're not holding onto a lot of inventory and you're able to test the waters with at least one offering, one drop first before you actually go out and try to do anything more proprietary.
Absolutely. Makes sense, right? Many of them, they also do just a drop collection, maybe only 50 items, whatever. And they say it expires on this Friday. this is the link. And at least you see, right? Like, in case you didn't spend too much money, you see how it goes, right? And they also put like that something like, you know, time sensitive thing, right? Like, oh, I have to buy right now because if not, and you have FOMO from your audience, right? I guess it's also a technique, right, for some of them.
Yeah, 100%. The drops have been really helpful. It creates the sense of, you know, scarcity. It creates the sense that if I buy this and I hold on to it, maybe it's a collector's item, first drop. And so I think there's that whole culture that's built into it. And so that's been really helpful from a strategy perspective of selling. And that's, I think it makes the most sense for creators who are of the correct size to work with third parties who can help manage that whole process. It removes a lot of the risk. It puts it in hands of people who have effectively done this over and over again, and makes it such that the creators can continue to do what they do best, which is create and focus on that and use their audience to continue to build out the sales from that perspective.
Absolutely. You can be fantastic and really great in doing content, but you might not be from day one an entrepreneur, right? You might not know how to find the right place where to produce things, the factory, the shipping, logistics, all the legal and agreements, like, you know, that it's involved. So I do agree. Like at the beginning, maybe get some support. And then once you see things scaling and you want to do better margins, maybe you do it by yourself. But if not, you can still stay with the platform that is going to help you from A to Z. So absolutely a good advice on that. And my last question for you today, then of course, you know, please add anything that maybe I didn't ask you. Overall, the creator economy, okay? What do you think about it? How is it going? What is missing? Do's and don'ts, anything that we should do, you know, like as soon as possible, because maybe there is a point of no return. So what is your final words? You know, again, a big question for you, but how do you feel about the creator economy right now?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because during the beginning of COVID, it was like, oh my gosh, the creator economy is massive. It's growing so quickly. Everyone's at home on TikTok, on YouTube, buying only online, right? So you had this like massive acceleration of saying the creator economy is now the focal point of all digital commerce, right? Like that sort of moment happened. And all the VCs started becoming creator economy experts, right? Like you had a huge influx of people who were, you know, focusing on creator, investing in creator companies. And we're investing in a lot of different companies, right? And a lot of these companies were promising long tail adoption and long tail retention. The challenge is the dynamics have shifted over the last period of time, and keeping those long tail creators and retaining them and finding more of them has been really expensive. And I think a lot of those businesses have been challenged to find consistency from a monetization perspective. And that's where I always talk, I've said a bunch of times, predictability. I think predictability has been really important in the space. And what a lot of the companies that we're invested in have had, you know, publicly announced layoffs, things aren't going as well as they were previously predicted. I think a lot of that is they grew too quickly in certain instances. In certain instances, they have a great idea. It was the perfect moment in time. The amount of creator engagement was really high at that moment in time, but it's shifted a bit. And that's paired up with a moment in time when venture capital is pulling back. You know, equity capital markets have tightened in addition to, you know, venture capitalists being now more interested in AI and in other areas of focus. So it's made it harder for creator economy businesses to get money and to attract capital, because I think there's been a little bit of a poor taste in some VCs' mouths from the performance of the cohort of people that we're invested in. Now, there are winners, obviously Spotter, Kajabi. There's other many, you know, large companies that have continued to deliver on that promise to creators. And I think it's just going to be important to recognize and provide sort of validation to those companies within the media from that perspective to show that there are, you know, the creator economy is still thriving. YouTube paid out, or I think it was like YouTube ad revenue was like $30 billion last year. If you think, if you look back to 2017 or 18, I think it was 17, is $8 billion. So like that growth is just amazing. And you have the same thing across all these other platforms. And so I think it's just going to take time to grow into some of these companies that raise capital. Like the creator economy is growing so quickly that it's just going to take time to continue to be a very, very large business. And I think it's just a shift that takes time. And so I think the biggest thing is patience, right? Like let's wait, let's see. We're at the early innings of these creator brands. I mentioned Mr. Beast Burger and Feastables. We have Emma Chamberlain's Coffee, which just sort of raised around. You have all these other brands that are being built. You have YouTube, which we talked about, but then you have these other monetization platforms that are being built out. And so I think it's just patience. Let's see how, you know, monetization builds out over the next period of time. And from there, we'll have a better sense of like, where is infrastructure needed? Where are the companies that are going to be supporting those businesses needed and helping push that the whole economy forward? So yeah, it's just all comes back to what are the platforms that are important? What are they building towards? And how investable does the ecosystem become off of that?
Thank you for that. So the message is be patient. Things are going to stabilize again, as it happens in every type of market. Anything else that I didn't ask you today that you're either excited to talk about or anything else that you wanted to maybe highlight from the questions before or anything else that you want to add?
No, I think you covered a lot of it. I think it's just, you know, the continued theme of actually one thing that might be worth talking about on YouTube specifically, because we've spent a lot of time on it, is the dynamics of digital advertising. And I think the information put out a piece a couple months ago that was talking about, I think viewership on YouTube is now 45% through connected TV. And the reason that matters is advertisers allocate budgets towards TV, and connected TV counts towards that. And so as advertisers saying, I want to move away from expensive traditional TV, which is having declining viewership, and find the younger, more engaged audience with more specific targeting, YouTube becomes a more viable platform that can take more ad dollars in, because almost 50% of viewership is coming through connected TV. And so I think that's a really interesting trend that is going to support YouTube, even if digital advertisers pull back because you know, consumer ad spend might slow. You still have this connected TV tailwind that I think is going to carry YouTube pretty strongly over the next, you know, 12 to 18 months.
Also, because if I'm correct, with the app of your phone, if you see an advertisement on the connected TV, you can actually click on the phone and open advertising there, right? So I think that Instacart and some others did it, where you can actually do, like, you know, maybe there is a recipe, whatever, you can easily go from the connected TV to your phone. And so you actually have, first of all, you have a smoothless, like, you know, process there. And also you can track things. Like, you actually track the people that went from connected TV to click on the link on their phone. So
it's the engagement and measurability are just way higher than linear, right? Like you're just, it's so much better from an advertiser's perspective. And so I think that's, you know, a strong positive. And I think one of the things from YouTube's perspective is the revenue I expect to hold up and maybe even grow this year, while a lot of other digital ad platforms might see some contraction. So we're excited about that and that tailwind for the whole creator ecosystem, and specifically YouTube.
Very interesting point. Thank you, Brian, for sharing that. And thank you for joining me today. This was a very interesting, you know, conversation. And finally, talking about capital and finance has been such a taboo, I would say, you know, for a long time, or very difficult just to understand, you know, financial and capital for content creators. So thank you for sharing your knowledge with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Amazing. And this was another episode of The Influence Factor by The Influencer Marketing Factory. I'll see you next week.